This edition of the Packet Pushers podcast is brought to you by Network Faculty, the multi-vendor training library, bite-sized IT training videos on demand. If you want to learn real networking, Network Faculty can help. Visit networkfaculty.com and sign up today. Welcome to the Packet Pushers podcast. This is a weekly or so show about data networking. If you work in a data center, if you work on Cisco equipment or maybe Juniper or F5, that kind of stuff, hey, you've come home. This is the right place. These are the kind of things that we talk about. I am Ethan Banks. I am a CCIE and one of the co-hosts of the show. You can follow me on Twitter at ECBanks, and I write in places like Network Computing and my blog, ethancbanks.com. And my other co-host here is with me, Mr. Greg Farrell from the UK. And how are you, sir?
I'm alive. I'm recovering from a flu this week, which has laid me low. Laid me low indeed. I've been sniffling and coughing and spluttering for several days. And just when I thought I had a beat, it came back again. It's just like a root flap. It just never goes away, does it?
No, it doesn't. Nice to have you, sir. And, you know, you've been up and down with health for a while, so it's glad to have you once again on the mend and sounding more like your pleasant and cherubic self.
Cherubic?
Yes.
What was that? Sound cherubic.
I sound cherubic just when I practice my vowels and speak with correctness. Thank you, man.
And if there are any cherubs that are truly representative of that particular species, it would be Michelle Chaburka, the host of Healthy Paranoia podcast and a longtime friend of the Packet Pushers. And how are you, Michelle?
Well, I feel a little bit like I'm slumming today, guys, you know, from the big grand world of information security. No, really.
Taking a step down to the lowly packet pushing, huh?
To the, yeah. The Symbian network, guys. No,
Symbian? Man!
No, I was telling, as I was telling Ethan earlier today, I snaked my bathtub drain and it still felt cleaner than doing information security work.
Thank you. I've been having a fun week this week with what I call security tards, which is these idiot tosspot security people, right? You know the types of security people that you just want to go, you just want to slap them and say, look,
I work
go,
with a lot
go
of
and stand, go and stand in the corner, stand on the naughty box, you're an idiot, right? And I've come to the conclusion, and in fact, I'm going to be running a panel in a few weeks at a major conference in London. And hang on, I'll find you the launch for it. But basically, my launch for the conference is: if you feel that you're security people, this is the IT security industry where you go and attend a conference where they teach you how to pick locks, and they compare their beards, or argue over the ponytail, or which mega fitness program they're in.
No, come on.
Published a podcast just the other week where that guy said, yes, we are going to have a lock-picking section, we're going to have a game section and a martial arts section, and we're going to have a wrist-slapping session, and, oh, yes, and it's a security conference. People are going to pay real money for these security tards to go along and pretend that their egos are bigger than some dickwad. I mean...
Okay, Greg.
Before we get too carried away, we better introduce the other two guests that have joined us in the virtual conference room here today. Paul Stewart, why don't you introduce yourself to folks, how they can follow you on the internet, and a bit about your background and what you do.
Yeah, I'm Paul Stewart. I'm a CCIE. CCIE is in security, but sort of in security because when I was going through the process of getting that, I was working more in the small, medium business space. So we dealt with broader stuff instead of deeper stuff, which happened to cover a lot of the security things that were on the CCIE. So I pursued that one. I've got about 15 years of experience in general networking and you know, working with organizations to build out networks. So people can follow me on the Twitter at PacketU, or they can follow my blog at www.packetu.com.
And also joining us today is Taryn Bryson. Taryn, same thing, man. Introduce yourself and tell folks how they can follow you and a bit about your background.
Yeah, well, I'm currently IT director for a company up here in the Seattle area that works in the nuclear space, oddly enough. I've been doing this, well, I've been in the industry professionally for about 22 years now, and I've done everything from programming to you know, systems to engineering to now the ugly side of it all, which is management. You can follow me online at blog.packetq.net. and my Twitter handle is someclown.
Thanks for joining us. So with the five of us around the table, this is a community show. We just wanted to kind of get together and flap our gums. And you could already tell by the tone we've set with Securitards, et cetera, that is exactly the kind of a show we're going to have. But you know, newsworthy in the industry this week was VMworld. So we're recording this today. It's the 31st of August. And if you're a Twitter person, you would have noticed that your Twitter stream had just VMworld hashtag vomit all over it for nonstop, pretty much from Monday. And of course, there were some big announcements that came out of that. And I think probably the biggest announcement, at least from a networking perspective, was VMware's announcement of the NSX platform. Now, Greg, I know you did some writing and research and got in on that. I was participating in some of the briefings, haven't really paid quite enough attention to have too much to say about it, but I know you wanted to introduce the topic of NSX.
Very exciting this week. NSX came out, which is obviously an SDN product. So the first thing I'd like to say is to all the people in the audience who wrote in to tell me that you're tired of hearing about SDN and it was never going to happen, sorry, it did. It is and it will. So there's going to be a lot more of SDN in your future. There's really no way to get around it. In fact, if you don't like the words SDN, you'll be very pleased to hear that Cisco is now calling SDN application-centric infrastructure. I've already created a shortcut in my Mac so that every time I type ACI, it just auto-expands, because I suspect there's going to be a lot of that in the future. So VMware released NSX. NSX is everything that you ever heard us talk about in terms of OpenFlow and controllers and applications and all that. It is that. Does it a slightly different way to what we have talked about it? Does it through overlay networking? So today it's in the hypervisor. You have, you know, the packets come out of the VM, it hits the hypervisor kernel module, gets encapsulated in a tunnel, runs over the network. So the big thing about NSX is works on any network, works on your network today. If you wanted to deploy it, works better on a new network because you need more bandwidth, because you use your network harder and more than ever before. The interesting thing about NSX, I think, that most people might have missed is that it is actually a new release of a product that's already in deployment. So companies like eBay and I believe Rackspace may have been using it at scale. So you're talking thousands of machines, not a small enterprise deployment, not whatever. We're talking thousands and thousands of machines. There are a lot of customers running Nicira, and yeah, NSX is here. And that's the big difference between VMware's NSX strategy and everybody else's, is it's deployed. It's real. It's happening. This is just the next release of that version of code, and it's integrated. So this is a real product that's shipping today for beta. It'll ship by the end of the year, I think, in GD.
Yeah, and I know for the bloggers, they'd put up some kind of a test lab so that you could go in and actually put your hands on the product a little bit. And certainly Brad Hedlund and Scott Lowe that briefed us were quite articulate about it. There's a lot of details and a lot of things that are there. This was definitely not just slideware.
And it's very interesting because the big thing, so you and I, Ethan, by the time this hits the ground, we will have published, I think, the VMware show that we recorded, a sponsored show we recorded with them, which is definitely worth listening to because it actually comes with a play-along, a read-along at home book about various architectures, which is a new way of doing things.
Yeah, Brad Hedlund had put together a slide deck of diagrams. They're just pictures. So as we go through the podcast, we refer to the different diagrams that show, okay, before NSX, your traffic pattern for this sort of a thing would have looked like this. After NSX, it looks like this. And then talks about why and how NSX brought the change to go from before and after. It's quite interesting. There's a lot of efficiency gains that are done there because they are creating virtual networks, as Greg said, via an overlay, now, which isn't, you know, in fairness, it's not like they're the only vendor doing overlay networking for network virtualization. There's other platforms out there that are doing that.
Yeah, plenty of them. You know, Midacura, IBM's Dove does it. Big Switch is moving into that space. Mbrain, NetSocket, you know, there's a whole plethora of companies out there. What is sort of becoming clear is that Cisco seems to be coming late to that debate. They seem to have missed this software and overlay. And I wrote an article this week which pointed out that, in fact, Ethan, really for the last 3 or 4 years, Cisco has been working on technologies like 802.1br, VEPR, VEB, where we actually did all of this software-defined type of stuff in the Ethernet, in the hardware, but none of it stuck.
Well, in fairness to Cisco, they've been a big proponent of VXLAN. They also keep trying to put Lisp out there as, and lately I'm seeing Lisp as a way to do multi-tenancy. They've actually extended it. So, I mean, but again,
yeah, but
going
it's still, it's not organized. It's still autonomous. So the big difference between SDN, which is we have an application and we configure the network like this, and that's the way it looks, right? And the overlay then uses the underlying network to be high availability and resilient. Whereas Lisp says, if you configure all of your routers and all of your switches and all of your VMs, then it will do it. But that means being able to configure all of your routers and all of your switches and all of your VMs to be Lisp ready. And they aren't Lisp ready. There's only two products in Cisco's line that got Lisp, and it's only certain line cards, and it's only under certain code versions.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody, you can't deploy it in your current network because VMware's ESX hypervisor doesn't have a Lisp agent. The CSR router that runs is still not out of beta, so you can't use a CSR router as a VM. You've got to have an ASR 9000 or a 1000, and if you're running NXOS and you're running this version of code with exactly this version of Blade, then you can have it on the physical. That's not a very practical solution.
No, and you could point at Cisco even more and say that while they've got the one controller, which has the code base of which has largely made its way into the Open Daylight project, there's still not applications that Cisco is selling, whereas VMware's got an integrated package now that will ride under your physical network or ride on top of your physical network. Cisco has got the physical network, but has not added a layer to do network virtualization. They've got a lot of the pieces and the parts, but they haven't put it all together yet. They've really been looking, I haven't really heard the message change much, where they're still looking to the customer to drive that functionality.
Yeah, so, I mean, I like Lisp. I'm very fond of Lisp. I think it's a great solution for data center interconnect. I think it's going to be a good tool if you want to do IPv6 migrations or do IPv6 over IPv4, more effective perhaps than using IPv6 over V4 or the other way around. And I think it's going to have a lot of applications for WAN and for VPN. But in terms of using it inside the data center for server mobility, theoretically that is possible, but it's just going to be so much easier to consume SDN-related products like NSX or Mitocura or NetSocket that you're just never going to use it for that, unless they can produce a product that, you know, brings Lisp into the Nexus 1000V or something.
Now, there's another thing, topic related to this, Greg, that you wrote about that I don't really have an opinion yet because I haven't thought enough about it. But that is going back to a slide that when, during VMware and NSX was being presented, there was a slide that showed a lot of the partners that were out there. Cisco was notably absent. Now, someone raised that case up on Twitter and Scott Lowe responded, don't read anything into that. In other words, don't get too excited that Cisco is not on the partner list yet. It's, you know, implying that either something's coming or it's not that big a deal or whatever, however you want to look at it. Now, Greg, what was your take on that?
So you could take a look at it in two different ways. And my preferred way is if I am in the networking marketplace and I'm an Arista, HP, a Dell, a Force 10, you know, those companies, and I need to get an edge on Cisco, well, VMware NSX lets me get to be in or instantly into SDN. So it makes sense for me to partner with VMware on day one. It doesn't cost me anything. I'm not giving anything away by instantly partnering with NSX. So what they've all done is just announced that they will have NSX support soon. Soon means by the middle of next year. So they ought to be integrated with NSX. A vendor must support an OVSDB agent, which is the Open vSwitch database protocol, so that the NSX can then send them configuration data. That requires them to add that to their code, to change their internal code so that they can take configuration commands to do, and the primary purpose is to do VTEP. And effectively what they're implementing at this point is an OpenFlow agent in their switches with an OVSDB to do the configuration. That's exactly what they're implementing. And they're going to do that with VTEP. So it's a very small, limited use case of implementing OpenFlow in their products so that they can integrate with VMware's NSX. Easy enough for Arista or HP or Dell to be able to say they'll have it ready by the middle of next year. Most of them have already got, and Juniper, by the way, they already have OpenFlow agents. So it's really just adding the OVSDB and then running through the certification process with VMware.
And a lot of them already have a relationship with VMware. They already talk to vSphere or the orchestration platform on some level anyway. So there's a lot of the groundwork already done.
I think that Cisco just wasn't able to get an announcement together in time. I think most of their SDN resources are over working with something. You know, we could hazard a guess it's in CIMI, or, you know, maybe they're all, they've got three or four different options on the fire. And Cisco felt that they just couldn't get an announcement together in time, and they'll have something shortly. So if you look at Cisco's product lineup, they have the 1PK. Now, you and I have talked a lot about 1PK in the past with their open network environment. And if you think of 1PK as any API that the world wants to make, 1PK will make it available to you. So if it's NetConf, 1PK has NetConf. If it's OpenFlow, 1PK has an OpenFlow interface. 1PK also includes a bunch of proprietary APIs that Cisco wants you to look at. So if you wanted to do crazy things like inject a static root onto a device and then redistribute that static root into OSPF, then 1PK has that for you. Well, so for them to implement an OpenFlow agent and an OVSDB and have VTAP support and integrate it with VMware NSX looks perfectly reasonably practical in some point in the near future. And I would think that they just didn't have it ready in time.
Taryn, we were talking before the show, and you were making the point that SDN really seems like a data center play, and it's very focused on that sort of a environment, cloud providers and multi-tenancy and so on. But it doesn't really seem like it's too meaningful for enterprise, at least from your perspective. Does NSX change any of that? Or maybe you just kind of want to state your case and we go from there.
Yeah, no, I mean, at this point, it's interesting. I don't know, you know, I wasn't at VMworld, and I've been following what Greg and some other people have written on it. But I don't see a use case in my environment, and I know a lot of other, you know, IT managers, IT directors who are kind of the same way as far as just SDN in general, not seeing a use case. Now, you know, I should point out, I mean, we're a big VMware and Cisco shop. We have Nexus 1000 Vs. We were one of the, you know, first companies to roll those out in the Seattle area. You know, so we're not anti, you know, virtualization. We started this down this road in like 2004, 2005. You know, I love virtualization. I love everything that it does for me, but I'm not completely sold on the NSX stuff yet. And I'm not completely sold on some of the other SDN stuff that's out there. I think it's incremental. I think it'll improve our networks long term, but when I look out at my budgets and I look out at my needs, I don't see anything on the horizon that would make me pull out my credit card for probably, you know, 3 to 6 years at the earliest. And I think a lot of enterprises are probably in similar places.
I would disagree. I mean, we're in the midst of building a new cloud, and we're heavily leveraged where I work in AWS as well. And there's a lot that's attractive in NSX in that we feel like it's going to help us have some of the same nimbleness that we have had in AWS. And we're really excited. We're like, how soon can we do it? We're looking at overlay networking. It just presents a lot of opportunity for us in the way that we work. You know, I work for a media company, and it just, we're excited about it.
You know, interestingly enough, the two people I've talked to that actually are really excited about this in the enterprise space, not multi-tenant, you know, data center type environments or any of the hyperscale guys, these other two people have also been in media companies. And I'm kind of wondering if that, you know, I don't know if there's, that's not bad. Yeah, that's not bad at all. I mean, obviously I'm in a different space. I'm just kind of curious if there's something unique in that environment that would.
I think so. It's the way we have to respond in terms of development. You have to be so nimble and so fast and move things around so quickly and respond to developers. They expect it yesterday. They don't want to hear a waterfall process. It's all agile, and they don't care if it costs more money sometimes to do it in AWS. At least it's faster, and sometimes that's what it's about. And I think
that's that the early adopters will be the people who need to move faster, and the second one will be people, and this will be a little bit further along until people realize that NSX enables a new security model.
Yeah, that's so, what the part that excites me a lot. Yeah.
The killer aspect of VMware NSX that nobody's talked about and nobody seems to understand until you get on a whiteboard and start to explain it. And I think I did it with you recently, Michelle.
I'm so like, yeah.
You've got it. Once somebody points it out to you, you get it and you go, holy cow. This changes everything. And the answer is it's the multi-tenancy that VMware NSX enables. Secure, auditable, controllable, all of the crappable security words that you want to throw at.
And it's not just that. I've been wanting it. I was actually asking questions, I guess, a year ago of you and Ivan. And because I saw what it could be, and I went, what do you mean it doesn't do that now? Because even when you're not in the traditional sense of the word multi-tenant, when you're in a media company and you're working with developers and things, in a way you are multi-tenant. You treat your development staff like tenants.
I think that's the reality of it. Taryn, to kind of go back to the point that you were making earlier, you're not seeing an immediate use case, and I think that's fair because you've got a network that's working. But what I'm seeing for the enterprise space that's interesting here is that you could build one big network and then build an overlay for every, however you wanted to segment your business out. So if you had a development environment, you can layer that as an overlay on top of your physical network. And then you've got if you're a big development shop, let's say you go to UAT environment, user acceptance and testing, and that becomes an overlay on top of the same physical network. And then that's another great. I used to work for a payment card processor. Okay, well, we had built out physically separate networks for all these different sections of our network. We had a segment that faced the merchant network, and we had a segment that faced the corporate network, and a segment that faced the authorization network, and then there were more of them. And we traversed everything through firewalls, through big honking firewalls, and load balancers. And so on. It all came into a big core for routing services. Holy crap, that was expensive. And you got to maintain it and upgrade it and all that. We could have done secure separation of all of that, maintained PCI compliance on one big physical network with overlays and had everything
now,
be separated.
More importantly, not only that, it's auditable. Because
right.
Keep in mind that your NSX controller is a single point of configuration. So if you want to see
the secret sauce, yeah.
That's the secret part, is you can go in and conduct an audit and say, where are all my PCI machines? Oh, they're in this software-defined data center. Okay, so tell me what that data center looks like. Where are all the VLANs and where are all the firewalls and where are all the IPSs for that virtual data center? You can see them all. You can validate the links between them because they're all done in software.
Not just that. Think about it. The part that we're looking at is the policy part. So yeah. You have the auditing part, but you also have, you can establish VApps and policies. And, you know, all of a sudden it's that dream of mine in terms of data classification and user classification and business rules. You actually have the ability to make that applied and mirror what your application data flows need to be from a security standpoint.
Taryn or Paul, I'm just curious if that, does this resonate with you guys at all? Or are you still saying, eh?
For me, I the question I would have is, how's this thing going to be licensed? You know,
love technology for its own sake. Don't get worried. Don't get hung up on licensing. It's about the tech and it's cool. Just buy it.
Now you sound like a Splunk reseller.
So, you know, recently just built out our primary data center, I would need another inflection point to get a technology like that into our environment, but it's definitely an interesting technology for sure. I am curious to how VMware will license it, and if they'll, you know, have a licensing model that they come down with that works, that they don't change in 6 months that makes it not work any longer. So
I heard they're approaching a licensing change of some kind, because we were talking to them about, I mean, it's just mystifying the when you start talking to them about licensing and the cost. It just, if you do this and it's this level and it includes this and this and this component, and if you go to this, it includes this many components. And it feels like, you know, trying to figure out Immanuel Kant and, you know, a priori and a posteriori.
Yeah, you need to hire someone just to manage the licensing for you.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, you got to watch out for that, because VMware's pricing engine comes out of EMC. EMC has a price for everything. Software. You want your software to have some software? Well, we've got a price for that. You want your cables? Do you want the connectors on the end of them? Yes. Well, that's extra. You know, that
sort of
thing.
Seems to be the trend too, doesn't it? It's like more and more companies are doing that. It's just, ugh. Yeah.
Well, and this actually brings up this actually brings up one of those battles that I fight every day, which is that, you know, on a personal level, and what we're talking about here, I mean, I find this stuff just absolutely fascinating. I mean, like I said, I've been a longtime programmer. I mean, just all this stuff is cool, right? I want to play with it. But, you know, I report directly to the CFO, and all the questions that I get on back to Paul's thing about inflection points, I mean, all the questions I get have absolutely nothing to do with any of these, you know, multi-tenancy or anything else that guys like us might talk about. The justifications I have to make are, you know, how is this input going to change the output of the business? I mean, how are we fundamentally?
Oh, that's easy. You can throw away 50% of your firewalls. You can throw away 50% of your routers, if not more, and replace them all with VMs. If you've got a modern-ish data center built in the last 5 years with a reasonable Ethernet backbone, you will never need to buy another firewall or another hardware router for the next decade, because you'll just move them all into VMs.
I mean, here's the funny conversation that we were having. So we're redesigning, we're moving to a new data center, we're having a discussion about the security architecture part, and here I am. I must be from some weird planet that doesn't involve the regular security realm, because I'm actually arguing against physical firewalls in the conversation. I went, no, 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 that's not what you want to do. You want to keep it in the ecosystem. You don't want to trombone the traffic out. And they're looking at me like I'm crazy. But
it's interesting you bring up that scenario, because when we did the podcast recording with Brad and Scott from VMware, that scenario came up, you know, how firewalling is done in an NSX environment for exactly the reasons you talk about, tromboning with a centralized firewall versus virtualizing the firewall and having them live out at the edge.
Well, you can get your sandwich now. You can't, if you want to do, you can either do one of two things. You could have that perimeter firewall if you don't have media sites and you don't need high connections per second, or you can have a load balancer, and then you've got more security controls on the inside. I think that's a reasonable model.
Well, especially if you can still centrally manage the firewall policies. You may have a bunch of virtual firewalls, but if you're centrally managing policy, it's still a very manageable solution. Yeah,
and it's not even necessary. I mean, you've got add-on products like HITRUST and CatBird that will give you the same type of policy levels and audit and controls that you get from that old school network segmentation with a firewall combo that is just, you know, hello, 1998 called. They want their security model back.
It's the management. It's not the fact that you're replacing. Although there's you're saving money, right? I worked for a financial institution, and they had a pair of really large Juniper SRXs in the core of their network to separate dev and test. And that was all they were separating. But they had to be 10 gig. And because they had to be 10 gig, they had to be 2x10 gig to have an alternate path. And then they had to have a pair of them. So now you've got an active firewall and a standby firewall, and the whole thing cost $1.5 million for a pair of high-speed firewalls to separate to create two virtual data centers. That's effectively what you're doing when you put a firewall between two zones of your data center. You're creating a virtual data center, right? Because security tards don't trust VLANs, right? So
Present company excluded.
Yeah, present company excluded, right? Now, we could wish to have MPLS in the physical infrastructure in the data center, but we never will. Bringing MPLS into the data center is impractical, because MPLS requires custom silicon that can't work very well in a data center environment. That's the discussions that I've had. It just indicates that MPLS in data center switches is highly improbable at any sort of scale for any sort of reasonable money. You're just not going to get it into a top-of-rack switch, because there's just not enough space in the silicon to be able to implement that. It's just not possible. You can't have MPLS to create virtual zones. You can't put cost of these physical firewalls at such scale. So if you look at way NSX does, or whatever Cisco's going to do, they're going to do something very similar. They're already doing it today with NX1000V. So you can get virtual security models where Juniper's got their virtual security gateway, Nexus 1000V has a firewall coming up, where the hypervisor agent has a firewall in it. Okay, so you put a firewall in the hypervisor, all of a sudden your reducing the dependency on one big ass firewall in the middle of your data center. That's a good thing. But what you're not doing is creating multi-tenancy zones. So what you really want to be able to do is say, how can I create something like an MPLS VERF without MPLS, because MPLS can't do what I want? And that's what overlay networks are. Okay, so overlay networks now gives me effectively an infinite number of VERFs in my data center. And I've got a central configuration point for all of those VERFs. It's not just randomly making up VERFs like MPLS does. So in MPLS, you sort of configure everything, and then you cross your fingers and hope it works the way you think it does. Overlay networks are definitively created and programmed by an operator. And as Michelle said, you can create a policy. You can say, if this server has this name, then deploy it in this data center. Or you can say, you log into the vCloud director and you see your virtual data center. You deploy a machine, it can only see these VLANs that are created in the overlay. You can't do anything else, right? You want a firewall? Create a VLAN, create a VM, and in there's a firewall. You want some inspection? You want an IPS? Create a VM, put it in there. You want some... Now, all of this is being centrally configured. Your assets are being managed. Your PCI auditors or your security compliance team can go into those virtual data centers in a read-only mode, right? So your sysadmins, your security admins now have the minimum possible rights, which is all they ever deserve. You don't need to give them root access to see the configuration. You can give them read-only access to every virtual data center in the estate. And it's that visibility that's the unique value for me. And the ability to put a stateful firewall in a hypervisor is cool.
But it is. You still get layers. You still have defense in depth because you can still do bump in the wire. You can still do. Then you can go out to the edge. I mean, it's great.
So, but why not have? I've worked in a nuclear site, and they're just paranoid about security, right? But at the end of the day, they basically declare everything as secure, maximum classification, and then everything has to have these crazy security policies attached to it, even if it's a SharePoint site. For the front desk to print out sign-in forms for visitors, it's still classed as top secret because it's in the same security zone as a nuclear trust. Well, if you could create a separate virtual data center and say that's just publicly available, move it over there, and there's zero communication between the two on the same physical infrastructure, you've just changed the whole cost model of your company. You can move accounts into its own virtualized data center. You can move the nuclear guys into a different virtual data center and then let your security team go nuts over those.
Now let's see if the PCI DSS short bus actually catches up with virtualization with PCI 3.0 that's coming out supposedly in January.
That's actually a thing that we deal with that all the time. I mean, just what you said there. I understand exactly what Greg's saying. That's actually the clearest explanation for the security stuff the security side of it that I've heard, and actually is definitely compelling to me. But I still have to explain to, as Michelle said, the short bus people, why, VRF separation is fine, and I still have to explain everything in terms of frame relay to these guys. They're still asking, well, why aren't you doing frame relay on these WAN links? I mean, that's how far behind, some of the government regulations are. So one question that I had, though, that maybe is and I don't have an opinion on this yet, but what do we think of putting so much trust, I guess, in one vendor for so much of this, with the kind of lock in and possibility.
You should have seen the report I just wrote yesterday. That's funny. That's curious. I closed with that notion. I think there is a danger there for early adopters of SDN. And if you buy NSX today, it's for sure going to solve certain problems you have, give you a management platform and all the other wonderful things that Greg was just going on about. So for sure, you can assign a dollar value to that. You can assign an operational model to that for your organization and figure out how NSX is going to fit in and go, yep, I want it, and then buy it. And then are you ever going to be able to use anything else going forward that's SDN related? We have no standards in the SDN world per se. We've got OpenFlow, more or less a standard that not too many people are adhering to in any predictable way at this point. But aside from that, I mean, SDN is so much bigger than just OpenFlow, and there's no standard. Every vendor is doing their own thing. So I think that is a legitimate concern, that if you buy into a big platform these days, it solves problems you have today. What about 3 years from now? What about 5 years from now? What happens when you want to change and go on in some other SDN platform? What do you do? Because you could have married yourself really to that platform and make it very, very difficult to move away from it. Some organizations really are not able to make change as well. When Cisco came out with the Catalyst 6800 line, Greg and I are both going, why did you do this? Why are you persisting in keeping the monolithic iOS, you know, going on? And the answer that Cisco gave us was customer demand. They did not want to change their operational processes at all. So companies that were heavily invested in the 6500 line could go right into the 6800 line and not have to change their operations. They could use the same scripts, the same text, the same, you know, staff knowledge and take advantage of that. Okay, so some folks have such a hard time changing with something as simple as a network switch. What the heck is it going to be like if you're trying to change your SDN platform somewhere down the road? And there's a million reasons why you might want to do that. I do think that's a legitimate concern. Well,
you notice they're trying to get you to buy into their entire... They don't want you to just drink the Kool-Aid. They want, you know, they're doing Jonestown, right? So they have those VMware-approved data centers now, the cloud computing centers, where you host in places that are partners with VMware. So you buy into their model and then you do the hybrid cloud with their partners. So they're thinking bigger than just selling you the ability to create this nimble private cloud. They want to own you.
Let me address a couple of points there. One is NSX works for OpenStack and also for Hyper-V today. You can go and pick your favorite, right? Now, and Cisco will give you exactly the same solution. Whatever Cisco produces, it will also be Hyper-V, OpenStack. So if you want to bet your network on something, I'll bet you go and buy the Cisco proprietary solution. There's plenty of examples of proprietary solutions today. One's called Microsoft Active Directory, and everybody seems to have bought in that wholesale, right? So when people want to throw to me like, oh, what about proprietary? And all I have to say is, well, do you use Active Directory? And if they say yes, I say, right, well, you've just lied. You've just proved yourself to be a fool, right? So I do not in any way, shape, or form subscribe to this, you know, it's a lock-in. People lock in all day, every day. The question is, what can you do to mitigate the lock-in? So in the SDN space, we have two standards today that you need to be looking for. One is OpenFlow. So everything that NSX does and is OpenFlow. They literally program their switches using OpenFlow. Today, it's a slightly proprietary version of it as the standards come up. So if you're going to go out there and talk to go and buy an SDN solution, just make sure that the underlying protocol in it is OpenFlow, because that is the standard. There's plenty of companies producing proprietary implementations between the vSwitch and the controller. Don't buy those. Go and get OpenFlow. That'll give you a chance of integrating with hardware, because if you're doing a hardware vendor, they're going to have an OpenFlow agent because that's the standard. The second one is OVSDB. OVSDB is the Open vSwitch Configuration Management Database. So this is how you configure a virtual switch. This is how you configure the port on a hardware device. It's a separate protocol, but functionally it's the same as OpenFlow. So make sure that whatever you buy is OVSDB ready, because that's what NSX does, and that's what most other people are going to use. Open vSwitch, which is what's in KVM, which is what's in OpenStack. And so it's going to be the dominant protocol for configuring SDN ready. So start moving down that path. To my mind, those standards are very, very clear.
But you got to qualify what you mean by make sure your vendor supports OpenFlow, because what that means today varies dramatically by vendor. And you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's version support.
Sure do, right? But what you need to do is when you're sitting across the table, say to them, I want you to tell me that you've got an ironclad guarantee of support for OpenFlow, OVSDB, and I want you to support the Open Daylight Controller. And I want unequivocal guarantees that you support all three.
And there's a performance issue too. And that there's a performance issue too.
Sure. All that other stuff, right? But if you're looking for standards in SDN today, they're the three things you're looking for.
Yeah.
Open vSwitch is the de facto switch that everybody uses. And so Open vSwitch is in KVM. It's defined in OpenStack, and it's the largest deployed cloud. Like VMware's cloud is nothing compared to what OpenStack's going to be in the near future because of the size of the companies that are using OpenStack, you know, Rackspace, tens of thousands of VMs in a single space. And so they're all using Open vSwitch. So Open vSwitch sets the standards by de facto, right? Now, plenty of other people would like to think that life will be different, that they could define a standard and go to the IETF and create new whatever. Running code is what defines the rules. Open vSwitch uses OpenFlow and OVSDB to be programmed. That isn't going to change. That's the de facto standard for configuration. Open Daylight is the same. It's the open standard controller. So whatever APIs Open Daylight defines will become the de facto standard for controller-to-controller federation, northbound, southbound, and east-west. they're the protocols that you're looking for standardization, right? So sure, they're not here today. And that's because people like Brent Salisbury are writing the code. They're not here yet, but they are coming, and they will come in the form of code from the Open Daylight Project, and they are concerted efforts. That's the standard that you're looking for. It's not as elegant as we might have, but as I said, if you say to me, "Oh, I want standards. Who's gonna? Who do I? I don't want to get lock-in." And as soon as you tell me you're running Active Directory, well, then you've already locked in for your identity management right there. As soon as you buy a Cisco switch and implement their OSPF protocol, you're pretty much locked in to Cisco's routing protocols, right? Well, how many people are out there running EIGRP and locked into Cisco networking? People got the same problems with firewalls today. They locked in because they have checkpoint. They can't get rid of them because all they know is checkpoint, right?
I can't believe you just said that word.
Yeah, well, I mean, checkpoint firewalls are so hard to use.
Yeah,
and it's so complex that you actually have people who specialize in checkpoint. I mean, that's silly.
Well, the worst thing is
it's so easy to use and so simple to deploy that it should just be like a 1 hour a day job to mount and deploy your firewalls. But checkpoint makes them so complicated that they become
the logging,
a
logging. Yeah, they've got to have proprietary logging. They've got to get that special OPSEC-LIA API. You know, it's just everything has got to be different with checkpoint.
Well,
yeah,
this is a good segue into moving this conversation in a little bit different direction. Which is this. We've been talking about software-defined data center. We've been talking about VMware NSX. We've been talking about changing the security model and how implementing a software-defined network with overlays can change the security model. And yet, you've got a lot of security companies out there that are pushing next-gen firewalls. Now, Paul, you had brought this up. Were you in the process of evaluating a next-gen firewall? Or?
Yeah, just thinking about things that we may be doing in the future. You know, some of the firewalling stuff that we've talked about thus far in the show has been more around inside the data center. I'm thinking about more along the lines of Internet Edge and, you know, how do we protect ourselves there? And so having a lot of experience with layer 4 and below firewalls and less experience with next-gen firewalls. I'm curious to what people are doing there with maybe the ASACX or the Palo Altos, what works, what doesn't work, what's hype.
I think it's all hype. There are bypasses for all of it. They become choke points. And this is funny because as a security person, I mean, a network guy came to me the other day where I work and said, "What do you think about these next-gen firewalls?" And I said, I don't buy it because it's just a different – it's a way of marrying – it's a new language. It's a change to the taxonomy where they take IPS, they smush it into a firewall, and they try to convince you it's something new. And it's just a repackaging of, you know, the same old – thing that doesn't really work very well. Intrusion prevention is a misnomer. It isn't. It doesn't prevent anything. You're still working on kind of a glorified signature model that doesn't, you know, if you fight malware and attacks to any degree, you know that you're losing. We're losing the battle. Yep. And I don't care how many next-gen firewalls and how many threat intelligence feeds you have, and I don't believe it.
So we sort of started out with IDS, which was purely a detection mechanism. We started calling it IPS, which sort of operated in the gray area, and then, you know, stops some things and prevents some, you know, allows some things.
It stops usable user traffic. That's what they stop.
Yeah. I was just thinking, yes, I know what IPS is stop. They stop the network from working and cause an influx into your help desk. That's what they
especially
call it.
Especially when they tell you that they fail open, which is a lot.
Yeah, right? And that's a real problem. You know, when anytime that something doesn't work, you go point at that box. You know, yeah. Well, it's probably that box. And then, you know that you have problems with that solution if that's the first place that you go to troubleshoot everything.
And IDS is more network forensics than actual detection. That's what I'm finding every day.
I put an IDS in when I need to tick a box. I don't actually use it.
Yeah, exactly. You hit the compliance for the GRC guys who come in and they're like, "Well, you're supposed to have an IDS. Yeah. It's on the sheet." Yeah, we have one. And it's great when you're after you've been attacked and you're trying to break down, for example, how many people clicked on this link or what was the path it took. I mean, having that data is good for forensics and for your cyber insurance claim and things like that. But to really depend on it. I mean, I can't tell you, you know, IP reputation databases, there's one. I had to explain to the SOC the other day. I said, please, if it just is an IP reputation hit, don't call me in the middle of the night. I want a second piece of evidence to correlate with that. I want a second hit, because every time it's a false hit.
So Michelle, you've stated a very cynical view of IDS technology, basically layer four and higher. Deep packet inspection, you're saying, toss it out, it's more or less worthless. Now, the companies that make this stuff are going to make the case that Palo Alto Networks, for example, they're going to say, we give you a dashboard and the ability to write a policy that lets you very granularly control what your users can do. And actually, they sponsored a show. Well, we'll get to bypasses in a second, but they'll make the point that, hey, you can control whether or not your users can do X on Facebook. So you don't have to categorically block Facebook. You can let them use Facebook, but only do certain things on Facebook, to make sure that they're being productive, to make sure that they're not giving away corporate information, to make sure, you know, whatever. And I think that that's a fair case to make. On the assumption that those tools work and work reasonably predictably, then you can make a good use of that tool for your environment. Now, you talked about bypasses. Okay, so is the average user likely to know how to go around and how to circumvent these security measures, Michelle?
You've got that kind of bypass, that technical bypass, or you've got the exec who says, well, why? I don't want you to. I want to be able to post to Facebook, and he's higher on the food chain than you, so you have to like take off your controls. I mean, that's the standard thing that happens every time. I mean, your policies and the firewall, the next gen firewall, is just a way to implement a policy, you know, an information security policy, and then somebody tells you to back it off because they're important. So then what are you left with? I mean, I am more concerned. I'm less concerned about these granular little individual acts that a user can do. If we're actually architecting the environment properly in the first place, if we're thinking about data classification, if we have the catalogs of all of our applications and the data flows, and we classify users and then we segregate them accordingly, I don't think we're going to have to worry about so many tools. I just think it's the wrong path to go down.
Philosophically,
we're never going to win. It feels like whack-a-mole. It is. I mean, we have a bunch of sexy appliances, and I spend my day still chasing things down. And they miss things. I mean, we missed a lot of malware, and it's depressing. You know why? I know why police are become alcoholics now, because it's so depressing, because it seems to be a losing battle, and they come in and they promise you the moon and the stars, you know, the vendors come in, they promise you're the C-level guys.
Whitelisting and blacklisting is failing. You can't create a blacklist of all the evil stuff, because there's always more evil stuff to find, and you can't create a whitelist because it's too intensive. Yeah. To maintain. How do you maintain, you know, if you've just got a firewall and you say allow Facebook, you have to allow everything or nothing. So a layer 7 firewall says, well, I could allow this person to access this just one app on Facebook, or this corporate login on Facebook.
Then you spend all your day doing, okay, but this person, well, this person said you did it for him, and I'm going to submit, you know, it's like, where does
so
it
then
end?
You have the social media department can log into the company accounts, some director comes down, and it becomes just so resource intense, it becomes so costly to maintain them, that you need a policy engine to be able to just, you know, what you really want to be able to stand there and say, yes, so-and-so can access this part of Facebook, and then the firewall goes off and does it. That's what you really want.
I mean, to be honest with you, I start to look at computers as consumable now, as personal computers and laptops and devices as completely consumable. If I even have a hint that you touch something that's unclean, I'm more likely now to err on the side of caution and just say, wipe it, reimage. It's just too labor intensive to do. Most organizations don't have the cycles to sit there and research it and do malware analysis. Do you know how long malware analysis takes? And then what if you have to get into reverse engineering? Because you've got to know. It's just, you know what? I'm going to thin slice it. I'm going to take the circumstances, get enough details together and go, well, game over. Take it to the help desk, get it reimaged.
You know, so the challenge is that particular scenario that you threw out there, the Facebook and the executive, whether it's the next gen firewall or anything. I mean, that's something that's we have to address somehow. Or, you know, I don't know how we address that in
dirty net.
Case.
Get them a dirty net. I mean, that's
well, yeah.
You know, I work for a media company, and a lot of these users, just like when I worked in EDU, they have to be able to get to stuff that's dangerous. It's really a conundrum for me. But, you know, in my way of thinking, okay, I want those users that have to access that questionable material, I want them segregated from other parts of the community. And then I want to consider the network that they're on as low privilege as possible, almost like a dirty net. I think that's the trick that we have to start. The problem is we buy tools before we really understand what our problem is and what we're trying to accomplish. If we actually design in the get-go with a security architecture in mind, if we do an enterprise security architecture, then I think a lot of this stuff will be easier to deal with.
So Michelle, bring it back around to NSX, which is how we opened the conversation. When we think about re-architecting security and what NSX and overlay infrastructure, virtual firewalls pushed out to the edge, central policy management, that doesn't address layer 4 through 7, but how does that make you feel from a security perspective?
Does it make me feel? I mean, I like the idea that now we're thinking in terms of, I like the whole VAP construct, that you're thinking in terms of an application and what kind of flow needs to happen and the permissions and everything else and the policies surrounding it. It actually makes more sense to me to come in and start having discussions about, you know, firewall rules and VLANs and stuff before you even have the conversation about, you know, what is the intersection between the data and the user, between this data for this part of the application and other data that it accesses, before you have, you know, to start like throwing in firewalls willy-nilly without having that initial conversation is, to me, seems like such a waste of time. And to me, it seems like NSX facilitates a better conversation. It's a more evolved way of talking about networking and security and how they complement each other.
There is an opportunity with software-defined network to really change how we do security.
Yes.
But I think there is, I won't say a need, but I think it makes life easier if we are willing to forego some of the IPS functionality because of what you said. If you are willing to take a host that gets compromised, nuke it with a reimage and start over, that's useful, and work on strong protection for your infrastructure as opposed to your edge, your client edge, I should say.
Yeah, you know, Wendy Nather just wrote something really interesting. She basically said, because she was talking about, you know, the big thing now with malware detection is, you know, the sandboxing devices like FireEye, and, you know, a lot of other companies are doing this as well. And it's in line, a user hits a site, the malware detection engine throws it into a bunch of virtualized environments and quickly comes back and tells you if it's bad or not. And she said, so the dirty little secret, though, that information security isn't really saying aloud is that we have given up on prevention. What has really happened is that the trend is that we're now trying to figure out steps for mitigation, and like the intrusion kill chain, you'll hear that referenced a lot. Where, how soon can you break that intrusion kill chain before it gets to gets to your keys, the central soft underbelly of your infrastructure, right? And I think that's really the discussion to have. For a long time, information security people and even vendors, I think, cater to this a lot, this illusion, this denial of reality that we're not preventing anything. So I just want visibility. That's all I need. I mean, and we didn't discuss it, but the other thing that this new architecture enables me to have is visibility into the virtualization environment. I mean, there are phantom taps, virtual taps that get me into the hypervisor. And so I can see the traffic without having to tell somebody, no, pull it back out and then go back in just so I have it in my IDS or my IPS. I just want visibility so I can see what the damage is and maybe minimize further damage, but I don't fool myself anymore into thinking that I'm actually preventing anything.
Well, if you've got that visibility, then you've also, and you're in a highly virtualized environment, recovery becomes a more straightforward process too. If that was a virtual guest OS, bring it back to the last known good time. Go back in time to that point.
I think that's the most important part, actually. I think, and because I don't see that a lot. It's just this level of shock and, oh, what do we do now?
I think software-defined networking and OpenFlow does bring some interesting things to security. I mean, if you think about, if we could have an OpenFlow controller that the applications could basically request, you know, what flow should be able to be instantiated and not, then basically the entire network can sort of look like a firewall to some degree. And the open flow controller, you know, this flow is initiated in this direction. It should have a mirrored flow that will be, you know, initiated in the other direction in a split second. And, you know, it's sort of like a stateful firewall at that point, but it's controlled by the policies that are being requested by the application. And it's not going to do things, I don't think, at least, you know, I don't think it will. Maybe somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, looking at TCP sequence numbers and stuff like that, like our true stateful firewalls do, but there's some, you know, some controls that can live inside the network, I think, as we get to more of a software defined place. And then we can start focusing our efforts on the applications that are requesting the permission, the policies to be open. Hey, there's going to be a flow instantiated on this port 443 because I'm running a web server here.
I mean, and raise your hand, how many people have clean firewall rules anyway? Physical firewalls. I mean, they get audited, really. Yeah.
This is one of my favorite parts of SDN is if you've got lots of little segments, right? You can have lots of little firewalls. And that means auditing a firewall rule base is actually practical because you've got a group of servers. And instead of having a rule base of 2,000 firewalls, you'll have a rule base of 50 firewalls. And you could actually conduct a practical, reasonable audit. It's not obvious, but that's what you can do.
And at the end of the day, too, more and more of our traffic that we can see with our IPS and IDS and firewalls, it's becoming encrypted and actually more difficult. I mean, you know, we're looking at SSL traffic or SSH traffic or, you know, something that's encrypted in IPsec or something and part of IPv6. So there'll probably be more IPsec used because it's part of the protocol that can be enabled. So I think it's going to get to be more and more of a challenge. It's going to push the responsibility of the security in a lot of cases back out to the application where I feel like it belongs anyway.
Yeah, I think so. Because, for example, I've been asking the question lately after a discussion with Greg, I've started asking hardware vendors and security vendors, well, what's your support for Speedy? Do you have visibility into the Speedy protocol? The what? No, Speedy. The what? I said, we're a media company, dude. Come on. It's like, you know, and that's where there's still a lot of failure. And we're talking about, we're having conversations in an area that distracts people from the real conversation, which, you know, where do all the problems occur really? Where it's still SQL injection, cross-site scripting, violation of same origin. That's where the attacks happen. I mean, the New York Times, how did that get? That was the Syrian Electronic Army perpetrated one of the most simplistic attacks ever.
Well, and this is what I actually, Michelle, was going to, I mean, that was my next comment was if you look at all the security problems that we face and you look at, you know, what's actually going on out there and where the biggest risks come in. I mean, we're spending all this time checking off boxes to put firewalls and protect our network. And guess what? Somebody calls up the secretary and, you know, right. The secretary gives out her credentials. And why the hell does she have access to, you know, whatever it is that she gave out in the first place. Yeah, you've got Edward Snowden walks out with a USB drive, for God's sakes, out of an NSA facility. I mean, what does firewall do?
Okay, guys, you know what? I just wrote a blog post about this, and this is what really frustrates me. So the media keeps making him out to be uber super James Bond hacker. and frankly, what I don't get is the NSA basically invented SE Linux, okay, Mac, and audit, you know, we have RBAC and we have auditing, but apparently the NSA isn't using it. So
too much work.
No, it is. It actually is. You'll read Matt Simmons wrote a great post on the problems with SE Linux and why everybody just gives up on it.
Well, have you ever tried to use, I mean, I've, you know, we've probably all done it at some point, but tried to use encrypted, you know, email. I mean, my God,
teaching EGT, people, stuff like that. Yeah. Try teaching users how to use encrypted email. You have to do an interpretive dance around it. Okay, you give your public key, but not. Good job. Here's a cookie.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're at a good length for a podcast here, so why don't we wrap it up, and we'll do so by going around the table and just finding out a little bit about what everybody's going to be working on for the next week or so. And Paul, why don't we start with you? If you'd like to plug your blog or Twitter handle again, go ahead. And what are you going to be working on this week?
Well, we've got a long weekend, so I've got a short week coming up. So probably be writing an article or two over at packetu.com, and hopefully people can also follow me at packetu on the Twitter.
Awesome. Thank you very much for joining us, sir. And Taryn, what about you? Same thing. Please feel free to plug any of your social stuff. And what are you be working on this week?
Well, unfortunately, I'm working on a complete redesign of our web properties, so that'll be great fun. Nobody cares, least of all me. So on the social side, you can follow me on Twitter at @someclown. My blog is blog.packetq.net, and I've got some articles out for editing at some other larger sites. So once those come out, I'll plug those as well. Chasing the dream of being a poorly paid writer.
There you go. And Michelle, what about you?
Oh, I'm working on a Security Onion deployment because at least it's free, right? And it actually is really good.
Not only is it free, it doesn't suck. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't suck. It's actually good, and it has Bro IDS. Yay, Bro IDS. I'm having fun with that and still chasing down malware as usual and getting some writing done, working on my interop workshop on network segmentation and firewall deployment.
And of course, you can follow Michelle at Mrs. Y is Y on Twitter. And when's your next Healthy Paranoia podcast coming out?
I'm working on a couple of shows. I am working with, I'm going to have two of my nerd crushes on one show. I'm working on a VMware security show, NSX, with Brad Hedlund and Ivan, of course. And then I'm also working on a show about pen test drop boxes, because Taylor Banks just came out with the Rutabaga. It's a new pen test Dropbox that he came up with or is selling. So that's, I always like pen test Dropboxes. Those are fun little devices to play with.
And the Ivan she was referring to before, Ivan Pepelniak, who is at iOS Hints on Twitter, and his blog is blog.ipspace.net, a fantastic resource if you're not subscribed. Greg, what is the week hold for you?
I am back to building a high-performance compute network with multi-petabytes of distributed storage and thousands of compute nodes. And so I'll be building a network design for something that is 610 gig nodes in the first pass and to scale to 1,010 gig Ethernet ports in 2 years. Which is a real challenge because you can't have to do it 1-to-1 contention ratio. So that means for every 10 gigabits that faces out towards the front, has to be 10 gigabits going backwards. And most people's networking kit doesn't do that. So you need special stuffs, which is all very interesting. So, of course, you can find me raving on at my blog about if you want to track some stuff on VMware NSX. As Ethan said, we've been briefed a bit and we've had some podcasts. So I've been following through with it. Writing on the NSX here on my blog at etherealmind.com. Continue to follow me on Twitter as @etherealmind. And you can also find me on your favorite social media flavor, including Google+, Facebook, LinkedIn, etc.
And I am at EC Banks on Twitter. And of course, this was the Packet Pushers podcast. You can follow Packet Pushers at Packet Pushers. PacketPushers.net is our hub. That is where the community blog happens. A lot of engineers from all over the world writing great technical content and opinion pieces there at PacketPushers.net. If you have any questions about this show, you can send us an email, PacketPushers@gmail.com. We don't always respond quickly, but we do always respond. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.